Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Rules Committee. It happens to be June 1st, 2011, at 3 p.m., well, 3:05 p.m., okay. Just a quick announcement, House Bill 3653 will not be heard today. For those of you who are here, you can go home.
Can I ask why?
There's actually been some discussion with the parties that are representing both angles, both views of it, and they've chosen through the discussion with Chair Hunt and myself to actually sit down and have a good, healthy discussion to be prepared with a bill that brings common ground between the two sides come February.
That's what.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, you might want to open a work session if you're going to discuss it.
Okay, well, let's open up a work session on House Bill 3653. Go ahead.
So, I think it's just worth saying there were a series of amendments that were proposed, and I think each of the proposers of the amendments thought that they would address their concerns. The sponsors of the bill thought that the amendments would have created a new, different set of concerns. And so I think that the consensus, as we were just discussing in the hall right before this hearing, among both the sponsors of the bill and those who had concerns about the bill was that it would be better to get it right in February as opposed to pass something now that might get it right or might cause unintended consequences. And this is obviously a huge issue in my county, and fortunately my county chair is in the building and may even be in the room right now. But I think her sense was that there is a way that they can manage through at the local level for the next, 8 months, and make sure we get it right in February. So I think there is a commitment to dig into it even more deeply during the interim, do something that really does address the legitimate concerns of those who are dealing with these restrictions, not just in Clackamas County, but potentially in other localities, and do it in a way that doesn't have unintended consequences.
Excuse
me, so the people that are right now in danger of losing their farms,
Yeah, I would just go on. Unless you want to have another hearing. What I'm going to do at this point, rather than have further conversation with it, you know, either stop by my office or stop by Co-Chair Hunt's office and you can have the discussion with us at that time. We're going to close the hearing at this time, and you kind of get the drift of where we're wanting to go with this right now. Okay, so I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 3653 and introduction of...
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That's why I was surprised.
Yeah, just open a work session.
Open a work session on introduction to legislative council drafts.
Yes, we have two possible committee measures for you to consider. One is LC 4218, has to do with athlete agents, requires athlete agents to notify education institutions in writing before making contact with student athletes. That's LC 4218. You have copies of this. You want me to read the other one, or you want to go ahead with this one?
Go ahead.
The other one is LC 4217. It's related to health insurance claims by providers addressing refunds and resubmitted claims.
Mr. Chair, I move the introduction of LC 4218, dated 5/25/11. You want me to do them both in one motion? And LC 4217, dated 5/31/11, as committee measures.
Chair Hunt moves the adoption of LC 4218, dated 5/25/11, and LC 4217, dated 5/31/11, as committee bills. Is there any objection?
Just a moment, Mr. Chair.
One of the members.
We're good. I apologize.
He's okay.
Thank you.
Seeing none, so moved.
Oh, there it was.
You found it?
I found it. Okay. Apologies. Committee administrator.
Okay. Close the work session on introduction of committee bills. And I'm going to open up a public hearing and a possible work session, actually a public hearing at the time, Senate Bill 976.
Mr. Chairman, this is Senate Bill 976. It establishes the Law Enforcement Medal of Ultimate Sacrifice and creates procedures for awarding the medal to families of law enforcement officers who died while performing duties or were killed because of employment as a law enforcement officer. You have the Dash 1 Amendment. As a seventh member to the Governor's Commission on the Law Enforcement Medal of Honor, a surviving family member of a law enforcement officer killed in the line of duty, that is an existing commission, so this would add that member. You have revenue and fiscal. The fiscal impact is minimal, and there is no revenue impact on the Dash 1.
Okay, we have two panels, audience, and I'd actually like to invite some chiefs of police with on the first panel. So it would be Ken Johnson, Marvin Hoover, and Pete Kurtz. I feel like I've got to stand up for attention here.
Marv, you
want
to?
I will.
Your hands over here.
That's right.
That was a good bit.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ken Johnson. I'm the police chief for the city of Fairview. I serve as the first vice president for the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, and I have the honor of serving as the chairman for the Governor's Commission on the Law Enforcement Medal of Honor. Throughout the history of the great state of Oregon, the gift of liberty has been secured by heroes who have answered the call to serve our communities with dedication.
Chief, you can back off a little bit from the microphone. That'd be great.
How's that?
Thank you.
I have that habit. Sadly, some have paid the ultimate sacrifice. Is that better?
Thank you.
Since January of 2011, as you know, we have lost two law enforcement officers in this state who have paid the ultimate sacrifice. These brave public servants have given unselfishly to make our local communities and our state a safer place to live, work, and play. Never far from our minds is the ultimate sacrifice paid by those that are left behind. We all grieve for their loss and contemplate what we can do to ease their pain. The Oregon Medal of Ultimate Sacrifice would be presented to the family of a law enforcement officer who dies in the lawful performance of their duty. The award is intended to recognize the family for their sacrifices over the years in support of their loved one's profession. How fitting it would be to have the governor, on behalf of a grateful state, present the Medal of Ultimate Sacrifice to the families of a fallen officer. We would be honoring the fallen for their dedication, their compassion, and their determination, and recognizing the families with gratitude and respect, helping to bring closure to a very difficult time. The creation of the Medal of Ultimate Sacrifice will acknowledge those that have paid the highest price for freedom, but it will help us to never forget that they live on forever in our hearts and our minds. And I want to thank you and also add that we support the Dash 1 Amendment to add a survivor to the Governor's Commission. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Co-chairs Olson and Hunt, thank you for allowing me to come here and testify. Members of the committee, the City of Eugene supports Senate Bill.
If you'd identify yourself, Chief.
I'm Pete Kearns. I'm the police chief in Eugene. The City of Eugene supports Senate Bill 976, which would establish a Law Enforcement Medal of Ultimate Sacrifice. In April, shortly after this bill was introduced, the City of Eugene reviewed the bill and took a unanimous support position, noting the importance honoring those who had died in the line of duty or who were killed because they served as law enforcement officers. When the City Council took that support position on this bill, little did they know that just 9 days later, the reasons for the supporting the bill would hit so close to home, so soon and so hard to our agency. 9 days later, as you know, the City of Eugene experienced the loss of Officer Chris Kilcullen in a tragic and senseless shooting. While nothing can truly reflect the magnitude of such a loss, the Law Enforcement Medal of Ultimate Sacrifice would represent the acknowledgement that we all recognize that the brave men and women of law enforcement come in to do their jobs every day and put their safety and their lives on the line in order to serve and protect us all. Recognizing the great sacrifice these brave men and women and their families have given us is a thing that provides them with this right to this honor. It is the least we can do in their memory. In addition, we support the proposed amendment to add a family member of a law enforcement officer killed in the line of duty to the Governor's Commission on the Medal of Honor. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joseph.
Chair and co-chair and members of the committee, my name is Marvin Hoover. I'm the police chief for the city of Kalaskanai. And on January 5th of this year, I lost a very good friend who was a friend of mine for 28 years. I served with him on the same police department for 10 years, moved up through the ranks with him, and ultimately became chiefs of police in two small cities that share borders. I was there the day that Chief Painter was killed, and just a little bit of history. His oldest son is a police officer in Columbia County. My oldest son is a deputy sheriff for Clatsop County, and we in the small communities obviously are extremely close and know a lot of people. And by this, what we're trying to get through means so much to the family members to have the governor present this award to them. There's a lot of stress, as you well are aware of, that goes on, and something like this can be nothing but grateful to family members, and I hope that you support this. Thank you very much.
Members, questions? Well, Chief, I greatly appreciate you taking the time out to share this with you.
Thank you.
Chief Scott Russell and Vicki Jeffries.
Good afternoon, distinguished co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Scott Russell. I'm police chief in the city of Woodburn, and I'm here just to lend my voice to seek your support on this bill, and thank you for your support so far. On December 12th of 2008, myself and my very good friend and co-worker for 20 years, Captain Tom Tennant, along with Trooper Bill Hakeem, went to work hoping to serve our citizens and come home to see our family that evening. Unfortunately, that did not work out, and we lost two heroes that day. It's taken me about 2 years to get back to full duty, and I just want to be their voice today and let you know how much the men and women of law enforcement would appreciate the recognition of the job they do every day, that this medal would bring, and the support of the citizens of the city of Oregon for that sacrifice when that occurs. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Co-chairs and committee members, I'm honored to testify in support of Senate Bill 976. My name is Vicki Jeffries-Bilton, and I am a police line-of-duty death survivor. My husband, Portland Police Officer Thomas Jeffries, was shot and killed in July of 1997. I'm here to describe to you a few of the aspects of the trauma of public safety death that make it such a long and difficult process. The first of which is that it is often sudden and unexpected and a shock to the system. From the moment I got word that my husband had been shot, I couldn't feel anything. When the doctor had told me he had died, I could hear myself screaming, but I couldn't cry. In the days following, I drank milk and orange juice because I couldn't chew or swallow food. But I was pregnant and needed to keep my nutrition. In the immediate aftermath of my husband's death, I would go to sleep at night and dream of regular things, but when I woke up, I would wake up to the nightmare that he was not coming home. Every morning, I would get slapped in the face with the same harsh reality, and I quickly got to the point where I was afraid to go to sleep. Another aspect involves coping with the often violent circumstances surrounding the death. My husband was shot 3 times in a residential backyard. He was conscious afterward and gave suspect information to the other officers. He told them, call my wife. And as I later found out from the front page of the newspaper, he had also told his sergeant that he knew he was dying. I hadn't been told this, so I didn't believe it was true. But when I asked about it, I was told that it was, and that Tom had been upset in these last moments before he lost consciousness. Not long after his death, my dream started to reflect these images. In one, he was laying down, contorted in pain, dying.
I woke up sweating, and I thought, thank God he's dead, because the suffering was over. People may characterize survivors as moving on with their lives, as if they could leave the trauma behind them. But I believe it's better characterized as taking it with them into the lives they forge for themselves. I've been remarried for several years, and I've had three more children in addition to the child I was carrying when Tom was killed. I went back to school, earned my master's degree, and am in a PhD program. I returned to work as a college instructor. Still, years after Tom's death, I have dreams that leave me aching because I miss him so much. Years ago, I had a dream. He walked through the door, smiling with his happy-go-lucky manner, and said, "You should have known I'd come back for you." And his voice was so real, and I could feel him. Those dreams are a double-edged sword, both merciful and merciless. I believe that sometimes survivors can be trapped between forging a new life and the guilt of being happy. I have a beautiful family and home. I have everything that Tom and I wanted together. And I can't help but feel guilty when I find joy in something and know that I left him behind. Last year, I had a dream that Tom had been in jail all these years and was just about to be released. But somebody told him I wouldn't be waiting for him. And he was so hurt that he did something to be sentenced to more time. Even though I knew he was upset with me, I was so excited that I had been wrong all these years. And he wasn't going to be gone forever. He was going to come home, and I could visit him, and I could explain everything. Finally, I would say to you, that the trauma of public safety death is enduring. In the last dream I'll share with you, I was running from some people who were going to hurt me. I called Tom on the phone, but it went straight to voicemail. I called another number, but the phone kept ringing, and I realized he was never going to answer the phone because he had died. And as soon as I realized this, I started screaming. My husband was killed almost 14 years ago. I had this dream 2 days ago. These experiences are only mine. But from what I know of other survivors, we all have equally devastating circumstances to live with. As a survivor, I also want to know what I can do to help other survivors, including the newest ones from Woodburn, Lake Oswego, Independence, Rainier, and Eugene. I too feel helpless, and that is why I'm here, to hopefully illustrate to you how difficult and long this process can be. Although I don't know there is any way to prevent survivors from having to experience the pain, I believe you have an amazing opportunity to affect them in a meaningful way. I believe recognizing their arduous journey with the Medal of Ultimate Sacrifice will do this. Several other survivors I've shared the news of this idea with are very excited about it, and I hope you will consider it. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 976. Thank you.
Thank you, Vicki. Any questions? Representative Wingard.
It's not really a question, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank Vicki for being here today. It's nice to see you again.
Nice to see you.
And I am pleased to see that something that you and I have talked about getting a family member added to this group, is being amended into the bill. And Vicki has made me aware over the last year or so of how outside of the process family members can sometimes feel. And with this and some other legislation that we've passed this session, I think we've at least begun the process trying to open that circle back up and bring the family members back into it. So thank you for being here today.
Oh, thank you for everything that you've done.
Anyone else? Vicki, thank you very much. for the courage in sharing. And Chief Russell, thank you too. And Chiefs, thank you very much. Close a public hearing on Senate Bill 976 and open a work session on Senate Bill 976.
Chair?
Sure, huh? I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 976.
Chair Hunt moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 976. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so moved.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 976 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Hunt moves Senate Bill 976 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Amy, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Winger.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative
Gerber? Aye.
Representative Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Holby?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman? Aye. Aye. 7-0-976 has amended. Passes. As to four, do you mind if I carry it?
Please. You better.
Thank you very much. I'd be honored. Yes.
I just wanted to say thank you to the police officers. It's hard to sit through and listen to the story. I attended Chris Kilcullen's service, and it was very moving, and knowing that the police are out there every day, they don't get a lot of thank yous, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, moving on, we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 3662.
Chairman, House Bill 3662, Beth Herzog is going to be our administrator on it, but she is busy in her own committee. I'm sorry, this is Sandy Thiele Turk is going to be the administrator on this one. 3662. It expands immunity from liability for health care provider who provides services for a charitable organization without compensation, for a person providing outreach services without compensation, to homeless individuals or individuals at risk of becoming homeless under certain circumstances, and for pharmacists and optometrists providing services without compensation under certain circumstances, and it declares an emergency effective on passage. You have the dash 2 amendment, which defines outreach services to include medical and dental services provided by a health practitioner who is registered with the Health Professional Regulatory Board under current Oregon revised statute.
I think didn't Representative Wisnett?
Yes, we were going to call him. You call Representative Wisnett if maybe he's listening in. We'll come.
Okay, no, why don't we close this and move into a work session? Oh, there he is. Okay.
Yeah, there he is.
Representative Wisnett. You're on deck.
We're going to go this one.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much, Co-Chairs Olson, Co-Chairs Hunt. I'm just here. This is Gene Wisnett, State Representative, House District 53. I just want to thank the chairs and the committee very much for hearing this bill. It's a very important bill, and it sort of got sidetracked. I submitted a bill, and a colleague submitted a bill that got merged in Human Services, and they didn't make it out of Human Services, so I used the priority bill to bring this bill back, and I appreciate the co-chairs of this committee for agreeing to hear this bill. It's very important. We have too many veterans that are living in homeless camps, and we have a lot of great Americans that want to go help them. A lot of professionals that want to go help them. And that's what this bill is all about. You're going to hear a lot of testimony today about how important this is and what great service it is. I think you're going to hear some concerns expressed, and chairs, I'm willing to work with them real quick and get a stakeholders meeting together and address any technicalities that have to be addressed. But the bill is allowing professionals and social workers to go into these homeless camps and also put on special events without the concern of liability. And we have a lot of professionals in this state that want to do that and help, but they do need some assurance that they're not going to have to face liability. So I'm glad you're hearing the bill. I think it's very important. I hope you will pass the bill. We have to make some changes to address some of the testimony you're going to hear today. I'm very willing to do that. And if you have any questions, I'll try to answer them or ask my legislative assistant who can help me answer those questions about the bill.
Members, any questions? Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're lucky on this one. Okay. Let's see. First panel, call up McDonald, Matt, Chuck Hemingway, and Sarah.
That's fine. Bonsoir.
Okay. Chuck, you want to start us off first then?
Thank you, Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee. My name is Chuck Hemingway. I'm the Executive Director of Central Oregon Veterans Outreach, and we're stationed in Bend, but we serve all of Central Oregon. We're here to testify in favor of HB 3662, and we commend Representative Wisnett and also Representatives Thompson and Barker and the 25 other House co-sponsors of this legislation, including Co-Chair Olson and Representative Wingert and Representative Freeman and Representative Berger. I want to speak briefly to Section 2 of HB 3662. That section was incorporated into this bill from a predecessor bill. That predecessor bill was to help those of us who work with homeless veterans and other homeless populations. Section 2 has language that defines the outreach services that we do. When I left Bend this morning, I stopped by Bethlehem Inn Homeless Shelter, where Dr. Randy Jacobs, our medical director, was seeing homeless patients on our medical van. You have a letter from Dr. Jacobs in your materials. This afternoon, Dr. Jacobs and three nurses are at a homeless camp on the outskirts of Bend. Yesterday, a volunteer dentist extracted an abscess tooth from a homeless person as part of our outreach efforts. But despite the medical outreach that Dr. Jacobs is doing this very day and what the volunteer dentist did yesterday, Section 2, as it was introduced, says medical and dental services are not included as outreach. And that seems a little incongruous. We understand and agree with concerns that have been expressed, and we believe that we can work with committee staff and legislative council for any positive changes to address the concerns that have been raised or would be raised. Legislative Council has drafted a Dash 2 amendment that you should have before you, and we support that. We have suggested additional language, of which I've included in our letter, that we believe will positively answer any additional questions. HB 3662 is a strong, positive bill, and we support it. Section 2, as it would be amended, is a positive step, and we support it. Thank you for considering this important piece of legislation today, and we respectfully request a due pass vote of the bill as amended. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, we'll just hold off. Mac, do you want to
continue? Co-Chairs Hunt and Olson, my name is Mac McDonald, United Veterans of Oregon. If you want to reduce the suicide rate or begin to reduce it, if you want to take unproductive individuals in the state and make them productive, you'll pass this bill. Let me tell you why. A lot of homeless people do not trust government. They don't trust the Veterans Administration. They don't trust social agencies. And therefore, they remain homeless. They're not all alcoholics or drug addicts, as some people think. Some of them are highly intelligent individuals, especially among the veterans. Let me give you an example. In 1949, my brother joined the Marine Corps. In 1950, he went across the Pacific and landed at Incheon. From Incheon, he went up to the reservoir, came back out of the reservoir, sole survivor of his platoon, 44 men. He's the only survivor. When I came back from Korea, I was stationed at Quantico as a Marine. We talked, and I knew there was something wrong. But I guess I was young and dumb. But he was telling me how he didn't trust the government, he didn't trust the VA, he had a bad experience at the VA. And in 1957, stationed in Hawaii, I got a call from home. My mother told me that my brother disappeared. We found him 4 years ago after many months of making calls to David B. McDonald's all over the country trying to find him. Found out he had changed his name, and upon death, his daughter, going through his papers, found out my real name is David B. McDonald. But because he wasn't trusting of government and trusting of other individuals, he led a life that he shouldn't have led. The valedictorian of his high school class, Sergeant Marine Corps in 15 months, squad leader in combat, and died of cancer in Seattle, Washington. And I never knew it was there. Even sadder, his daughter lived in Chehalis. He didn't realize it, and she died before he did. But the way to get a lot of the people in homeless camps is to earn their trust. And one way to earn their trust is giving them medical support. And you go to stand-downs, veteran stand-downs, and you talk to them. A lot of them won't even talk to, they won't talk to social people. They will talk to people that served in either Korea, Vietnam, or World War II. And some of them won't even talk to them. The last stand-down I went to, World War II veteran came up to me and started talking, and he said, "Oh, you weren't in World War II, were you?" And I said, "No, sir, I was in Korea and Vietnam." He said, "I don't want to talk to you. I want someone from World War II. Where's someone from World War II? They're very apprehensive of any type of government and of individuals. But the way to reach them is through medical support. I've seen it happen before. Now, probably see it again. And in order to give medical support, the insurance premiums are prohibitive. $2,000 a visit is what one medical insurance company wants for medical personnel to go to a homeless camp. We need to pass this bill. We need to reduce our suicide rate. And we need to take unproductive personnel and make them productive citizens of the state of Oregon.
Thank you, Matt.
Chair Olson, members of the committee, I'm Sarah Holtz-Claw. I'm with the Partnership to End Poverty, and we're here in support of 3662. And thank you for hearing this bill. The partnership's mission is to remove barriers for low-income and homeless people in our region. Mm-hmm. One of our flagship's events is Project Connect. This event offers free medical, dental, and social services to over 2,600 people. And by far, our greatest need on this day and during our Mobile Connect events throughout the year is in the medical and dental areas. The demand is consistently 2 to 3 times what our capacity is. We simply cannot serve the need. We can't serve the need because we can't find the medical and dental volunteers to help. Central Oregon is lucky to have a robust medical community, yet we still have homeless in camps with untreated chronic illnesses, and we still have emergency rooms filled with people who have let simple illnesses and injuries sit until they're life-threatening. These are the people who are served by our volunteer medical and dental outreach. They have no other medical home, and they wait for a once-a-year event to get treatment. Yet we can't find the volunteers to help. Every year, we face the barrier of liability for our medical and dental providers. The insurance companies seem to have a grip on them, so they can't treat people outside their clinic walls. I'm here today to ask for your help. If we can help our medical providers, they can help us and the vulnerable Oregonians. Many who would like to help can't due to the unavailability or the extraordinarily high cost of off-premise liability coverage.
That brings me to section 2B of the bill. As Chuck said, page 2, line 10, I implore you to change the wording of this section to delete the word not, so that our outreach can include medical and dental providers. We use all types of outreach services, but at the highest need is the medical and dental ones that this bill would omit. Our mission is to help those in need. We do what we can, but in this case, we have to patchwork basic triage services together, and we can't do anything else without the help of medical liability and unity. In closing, for the sake of the poor and the homeless in Oregon and throughout the entire state, we urge your support in passage of 3662. Thank you.
Thank you. Community members, any questions? Very good. Thank you. I'd like to call Nicole, thank you, Deborah Herron, and Gwen Dayton. And ladies,
I will go. Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nicole Hoft. I'm with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I'm here today in support of HB 3662 and to share some background information about how the passage of this bill would impact efforts currently taking place to help homeless veterans. According to a joint in-depth study of homelessness by the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development and the United States Department of Veterans Affairs, military veterans are much more likely to be homeless than other Americans. During a one-night count, the study found that more than 75,000 veterans were living on the streets or in temporary shelter. According to the Oregon Housing and Community Services one-night homeless count, there are more than 3,000 homeless veterans in Oregon. This number only accounts for veterans who self-identify and the ones that could be found. One of the top priorities of the VA is to end homelessness in 5 years. One of the ways that we identify homeless veterans is through holding veteran stand-downs, where veterans can come and get direct services for food, shelter, clothing, health screenings, benefits and counseling, and referrals to substance abuse treatment. Stand-downs are collaborative events coordinated between the VA, other government agencies, and community organizations. They depend on volunteer health care providers, such as doctors, nurses, medical health providers, optometrists, and dentists, to get these services to homeless veterans. Between 1994 and the year 2000, stand-down served more than 200,000 veterans and their families. For some homeless veterans, the stand-downs are the only way that they receive health care treatment. The success of these outreach efforts and the will is dependent on the willingness of professional providers to volunteer their services. Allowing professionals to volunteer without fear of obscure professional risk would encourage much-needed charitable services to organizations and events like the veteran stand-downs. Thank you for your consideration of this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, members of the committee, I'm Deborah Herron, testifying before you on behalf of the Oregon Liability Reform Coalition, which is a coalition of businesses and individuals in the state of Oregon who care about the tort system and providing fairness and certainty in civil justice matters. We support the bill based on the principle that it would limit the expansion of tort liability and offer protections for those who are volunteering their services to charitable organizations. It's a good bill, do pass. Thank you very much, and happy to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. Gwen?
Thank you, Co-Chairs Olson and Hunt. My name is Gwen Dayton. I'm General Counsel for the Oregon Medical Association. I'm here because the OMA had actually expressed some technical concerns with the original way this concept was drafted. There is an existing process in Oregon that allows a healthcare provider to register with their licensing board and through that registration provide volunteer services, uncompensated services, and receive a limitation on liability as part of that registration. And the original concept didn't reference that, and our goal is the same as everyone else's. We want physicians to provide these services, and we were concerned that the lack of cross-reference would create confusion as to what law applied. So we are pleased to see that House Bill 3662 does provide that reference in what is included in outreach services. The original version of 3662 talks about outreach services not including medical or dental services provided by somebody who's registered pursuant to this process I just referenced. We think that that works. That it just says if you're providing services pursuant to your registration with your licensing board, that's fine. You can do it that way. We also, though, support the dash twos because it expressly says if you've registered with this existing process, your services are also covered under this express bill addressing the homeless population. So we are fine with either one. We prefer the dash twos. We prefer the dash twos because they shine a light on the homeless population that is in need of services and highlights that physicians and dentists can provide services to that population if they're registered pursuant to this other process under the bill that's passed. I'm glad to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm certainly sympathetic to what we're getting at with this legislation. I guess I'm curious. I'm looking at some testimony that was provided to the House Healthcare Committee on this, the earlier version of this, and it points out that there's already a federal statute that basically, I haven't read the statute, but it appears to provide immunity to volunteers for nonprofits who are acting within the scope of their responsibilities. So are you aware of that? Am I wrong about that? And if I'm not wrong about that, what is the need for the state legislation here?
Co-Chair Olson and Representative Garrett, if you allow me to briefly state what I know, but I will then turn the microphone over to others whose bill this is. There is an existing state law that I was just referencing that allows a healthcare provider to register with their licensing board. If they do that, they can provide these voluntary services without compensation if they provide written notice to their patient that they are providing these services pursuant to their volunteer registration and then receive immunity from liability through that using that process. So that process does exist in law right now, but I will leave it to others who are advocating for this bill to talk about the particular need to highlight the homeless population and particular need of a special recognition.
Mr. Chair, the federal statute that's cited in this testimony is 42 U.S.C. 14501. Federal Volunteer Protection Act of 1997. Does that ring any bells?
Representative Garrett, I don't doubt you for the moment, but I know there's state law. And that's
well, I haven't read it. I'm doubting. I'm not. Don't take my word for it. I just wonder if you're aware of it. So. Okay. Thanks.
Further questions for this panel? Thank you all very much. Appreciate you being here. So let's bring up our last. David Sugarman, are you testifying by yourself, or do you have somebody else with you?
Just
okay. So let's go ahead and bring up Bill Cross and Tracy Ornan. And those are our last three. Yeah, I'm with you, David. Yes, I'm sorry. Not in your place.
And David will go last.
No. So Bill, Tracy, not coming up. Just you. Okay.
I'll go ahead and take
care. So let's Ben, go ahead. Go ahead, David.
Thank you, Co-Chair Hunt and Co-Chair Olson and members of the committee. HB 3662 is laudable. My name is David Sugarman. I am a board member of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. In my private practice, I represent veterans, including a major case involving veterans from the Oregon Army National Guard exposed to hexavalent chromium in Iraq. And so I actually have to grapple with veterans' issues and immunity issues as part of my law practice. I'm mindful, by virtue of my work with my clients, of the various issues and barriers that our veteran population presents and faces. And anybody who's trying to deliver veteran services, I think, has to be lauded, and we appreciate that. I think, though, that 3662 has a significant group of problems, and the most pressing immediately is that both state and federal law already provide the protections that the proponents are asking for. ORS 676.340, Ms. Dayton sort of referred to that, is the volunteer medical provider process whereby you register with your board, you act within the scope of your practice, you provide care to somebody on a volunteer basis, and you make a mistake, you have immunity. That is in addition to the Federal Volunteer Protection Act that Representative Garrett mentioned just a moment ago. And the starting point here is I'm a little confused and concerned by this notion of these laws have been on the books since the mid-90s. Federal Volunteer Protection Act goes back to 1997. The Oregon state statute passed in 1999, amended in 2005. And one of the disconnects here is we're still hearing about problems. Well, why is that? I would submit to the committee that there's a real disconnect between immunity and insurance premiums. The carriers presumably know about these statutes and know very well about immunity. Certainly, Oregon Medical Association knows about it as well. So I don't believe that this particular problem fixes anything. There's some specifics in 3662 that also give me significant pause as a consumer advocate. Section 1, which nobody has talked about, plans to or seeks to amend corporation, charitable corporation, and replace it with a broader provision, organization. And I understand that the reason behind that is a concern that a particular organization, Boys and Girls Club, was not covered under this statute. In fact, we went back and checked, and Boys and Girls Clubs are an Oregon charitable corporation and should have been covered. So insurance premiums that are associated with that or insurance costs that are associated with volunteer medical care for that organization already enjoy immunity. Meantime, we want to broaden this and change charitable corporation to organization, and I can set up a charitable organization like that. We don't know what that means, and we do know that there are a lot of charities out there that are people, at least some, that nobody wants any part of. I believe that this creates immunity and unintended consequences where we don't necessarily want them. Moving on to the services in Section 2, I'm a little bit concerned about the scope, and I think there's some unintended consequences here as well. As we say, the case is made for medical care. We want doctors, we want dentists to go into veteran homeless camps. Of course we do. But they're already protected under existing state and federal law. But even beyond that, there are a few problems with this because there are a bunch of services listed in the statute that could trigger, for example, immunity from liability for somebody engaged in a foreclosure rescue scam. Mm-hmm. Goes to a vet or another homeless or about to be homeless person and says, hey, if you'll transfer your assets to me, I won't charge you anything to save your house. Congratulations, this committee may well have unintentionally provided immunity to that scam artist. Not clear to me based upon the provisions in the language. The last provision I want to hit is Section 3 and 4, which adds pharmacists and optometrists. They're already in the immunity list, and they're in the immunity list. If you go back to Section 1, ORS 30.792 gives you a laundry list of everybody who would be immune, and it includes optometrists and pharmacists already in the existing statute. So I think what may have happened here is some well-intended people took two bills through a process that kind of happens, merges them together, and we're going to see a bunch of unintended consequences. For that reason, and with all due respect to my friends and colleagues who are doing great work for veterans, we respectfully recommend that you oppose a bill.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Association and the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association. And as the previous speaker pointed out, the provisions relating to exempting or adding to the list of providers, optometric physicians, and pharmacists may already be included in the reference 30.792. We had a reference to another section where it talks about ORS 31740, and it does list a number of the providers, including pharmacists and optometric physicians, and that's a list of the punitive damages section. And so we need to look at what David has pointed out, and it may be that there is coverage already provided in the broader section that he has referenced. So we will look at that and let the community know what our investigation kind of resolves.
And if I may correct, thank you, Phil. I said 30.792. It is, in fact, 31.740 that is the laundry list. That is the list of providers exempt from punitive damages, and they're already immune when they're providing volunteer services. So again, we're doing, redoing, double doing, and maybe overdoing.
Okay. Mr. Hunt? David, I'm curious, based on your testimony, is there something that we as state government, state agencies, can be doing better in terms of better communication, clearer communication, more communication, to basically, because based on what I'm understanding of your testimony, there is a lot of coverage, some federal, some state, probably some overlapping, that would possibly encourage more people to do the kind of things that Representative Wisdom and others have talked about, but perhaps for the fact that they don't know that they have that protection currently. Is there something more that we can be doing or directing agencies to do?
I'm Representative Olson, Representative Hunt. I am mystified, and it's not for lack of action by this body. What mystifies me is that certainly those of us who have been involved in policy, and this was part of the Emergency Medical Liability Task Force and interim session study group through Oregon Law Foundation. Ms. Dayton and I were both ad hoc members of that committee chaired by Greg McPherson. Yeah, we looked at this in a lot of detail, and I know it's been studied in detail here, and the legislation is clear, and it's there. I don't have a good handle. It seems to me that the insurers know this, and if they don't, they sure should. And so when I hear somebody say, my carrier says it will cost X, I have to wonder one of two things, whether the carrier is in fact current on Oregon law, whether whether immunity in fact affects rates or not, maybe a question for the insurance commissioner, or whether there's such a preference for immunity as a policy default that all of this kind of disappears. Now, in fairness to everybody, this is patchwork. And so it's real easy to sort of, these things arise in different places, and they're in different places in the ORS. So in fairness, it may just be a simple matter of education, and it may be that this is one of those teachable moments where we can say, you know, we've done this. Now go forward and do your great work because you're covered.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While you've been talking, I've been busy looking at OregonLaws.org trying to figure this out.
Okay.
It looks to me, and please help me if I've misunderstood this, it looks to me like we've got a very similar immunity law twice. Once in 676.340, which this bill would amend by adding two new kinds of practitioners. And the other one in the two statutes you referenced, 30.792, which is the actual immunity statute, and then the statute it references to get to the list, 30.740, which actually gives you the list of the people who are exempt under, who are defined as healthcare providers under 792, and it gets you the immunity. Have I got that more or less right?
Representative Olson, Representative Hunt, Representative Barnhart, I'll take a stab. I believe, as I sit here cold without looking at the statutes, that the ORS 30 provisions that you're talking about relate to punitive damages.
If I could, Mr. Chair, 30.972 says, except as provided in subsection 3 of this section, no person may maintain an action for damages against a health care provider who voluntarily provides to a charitable corporation any assistance. Now, the list, you corrected yourself, and in fact, those two statutes hook together.
Right.
The other statute, 31740, actually contains the list.
Right.
But it looks to me, just looking quickly at these bill laws, is that we've already done this twice. Once in 676, and once in 30.
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, Representative Barnhart, I think you're correct, and I believe that the reason for that is the origin, and this was something that we looked at, and I think if Ms. Dayton's still in the room, she may have a similar memory or be able to confirm it. It's a little bit lost in my synapses, but I believe this study group that was through Oregon Law Foundation had exactly that problem where we were seeing kind of this patchwork piece. I believe that statute is Good Samaritan, and this is volunteer medical provider. The difference in the two schema, the second statute requires registration and also sets some limits on it. There is, probably the easiest way to think about it is, you've done it twice, and this would be number three. And that's part of my concern because of the unintended consequences.
Well, the final piece of my question, if this bill, the middle section of it, let's see if I can get the section number quickly, section 3 and maybe some of the other sections too, actually would modify 676.340 and so that it actually conforms to 31.  the other list, I think.
He actually is.
Now, maybe there's other, you've already indicated other problems with the bill, and I'm not going to argue with that, but it does seem like we have a patchwork. And I haven't looked at this issue before this minute, so.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Marissa James, if you'd come up and just kind of share a little bit regarding your letter that you sent concerning the Dash 2 amendments.
Sure. Also, members of the committee, my name is Marissa James, and I'm from the Legislative Council. First, I do want to point out, the 30.792 and the scheme in 676 are not exactly the same. They do a little bit different things. The 676 scheme requires registration and also provides that a practitioner who prevails in a lawsuit where they make a defense based on the 676 scheme is entitled to attorney's fees, which is a really important distinction in terms of, whether somebody's going to be willing to sue you or not. the 30.792 scheme does not require registration and does not provide attorney's fees. So they are different in significant ways, and, if the legislature wanted to make a policy decision, we could conform them all, but this is the bill we have with differences. With regard to the Dash 2 amendments, the bill as it was introduced excludes medical and dental practitioners, people who could register under the 676 scheme, from the new Section 2 outreach services. The reason for that is because of that attorney's fees issue, because I wanted it to be clear that I think it would cause confusion if you have two possible paths to immunity, one which allows for attorney's fees and one which does not. I think it would be more advantageous to the practitioners who are entitled to attorney's fees under the one path to only have that one path to immunity that allows for attorney's fees. So that's why I think that the Dash 2 amendments might cause some confusion.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, just a quick comment.
Yes.
It seems to me as though the whole set of statutes is kind of a mess. In two different chapters, with two slightly different lists and two different sets of meanings, it's no wonder the bill is difficult. And I'm not referring to the bill, I'm referring to the statutes that existed before the bill.
Okay, hopefully, Representative, you're not thinking of all the statutes that exist.
No, no, talking about these, I'm referring to this very small subset of the Oregon Revised Statutes.
I'm pretty much in agreement with most of them, I'm not.
Okay, we need to move on. Okay. Okay, thank you. And we're going to close a public hearing on 3662 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3609. So, Jim, if you'd explain what that is. And
Mr. Chairman, this is the House Bill 3609. This allows a public body to interfere with a person's free expression of religion only if the public body demonstrates a compelling government interest and that the public body's action is the least restrictive means of furthering that interest.
Okay. Representative Lindsay, talk to the rules.
Thank you. First time here. And thank you for giving a hearing on this. I sincerely appreciate it. My name is Sean Lindsay. I represent House District 30, which is Hillsborough and North Plains area for now. We'll see if there's any changes to that. Let me say a couple things. Some of you know that I like reading history, and I just finished studying some of the Dark Ages. It was a time where a cloud of darkness settled over the earth. It was a season of plunder and suffering marked by long and bloody conflict. Charlemagne was crowned the emperor of the Romans in the year 800. It was an age of hopelessness, a time of masters and serfs. The first 1,000 years after Christ passed and the second millennium dawned, the early centuries of the second millennium were a continuation of the first. It was a time fraught with fear and suffering. In the 14th century, the Great Plague began in Asia, and it spread to Europe and up to England, and everywhere it went, there was sudden death. And Boccaccio said it the best, I think. He said of its victims, "At noon they dined with their relatives and friends, and at night they supped with their ancestors in the next world." The plague struck terror in the hearts of people. In 5 years, it took the lives of 25 million people, one-third of the total population of Europe. Periodically, it reappeared, with its dark and ghoulish hands striking indiscriminately. But, this was also a season of growing enlightenment, the dawning of the Renaissance. As the years continued their relentless march, the sunlight of a new day began to break over the earth. There was a magnificent flowering of art, architecture, literature, etc. And there were reformers. They worked to change the church, notably such men as Luther, Melanchthon, Huss, Zwingli, and Tyndale. These were men of great courage, some of whom suffered cruel deaths because of their beliefs. And Protestantism was born with its cry for reformation. While the great ferment was stirring across the Christian world, political forces were also at work. And then came the American Revolutionary War, resulting in the birth of a nation whose constitution declared that government should not reach its grasping hand into matters of religion. A new day had dawned, a glorious day. Here there was no longer a state church, and no one faith was favored over another. The first provision of the Bill of Rights of the United States Constitution is what many believe to be the most important guarantee. It reads, quote, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." Notwithstanding its special place in our Constitution, a number of trends are eroding both the protections that the Free Exercise Clause was intended to provide and the public esteem this fundamental value has had during most of our history. Under current Oregon law, people and institutions of faith are substantially burdened to prove that they have the burden to prove that they have a legitimate claim to their religious practices. When the burden should, based on the First Amendment free exercise guarantees, be placed on the shoulders of the state to prove that the state has a compelling interest to limit or disallow religious practices in question and use the least restrictive means possible when following through. There are religious freedom restoration acts that are being passed by the states, and I believe that state religious freedom restoration act is needed here, because what Mr. Hamilton will explain shortly, federal law no longer provides the protection for religious liberty that it once did. Many states have moved and are moving to enact religious freedom restoration acts. Some of these states include Alabama, Arizona, Connecticut, Florida, Idaho, Illinois, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, New Mexico, Ohio, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, South Carolina, Texas, Vermont, Washington, Wisconsin, and of the yesterday, North Dakota officially began considering it. I will note that in September 2000, the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act, RLUIPA, was signed into law, that's federal law, which restored the compelling interest test in most cases dealing with the application of land use and zoning law to property owned by religious persons or institutions. It affords religious freedom protection to prisoners and other persons in the custody of the state. In light of this, I have offered an amendment that I believe is being passed around that will strike Section 3 of House Bill 3609. I thank you for giving some consideration.
Mr. Chairman, we have copies of that amendment now for people who want them.
Thank you.
Are you done?
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Co-chairs, Representative Olson, Representative Hunt, good to be with you again. The Oregon Religious Freedom Act is something
If you'd identify yourself.
Yes,
for the record,
I'm
please.
Sorry. Greg Hamilton, President, Northwest Religious Liberty Association. Thank you. The Oregon Religious Freedom Act is something we've been working on for number of years. In fact, Representative Hunt and myself have worked on this legislation going back, I think, starting in 2005, and maybe sooner. I'm not sure when. 2003. Okay, I was not sure about that, but it's been a while. And I started even with this with Charles and Bruce Starr and Dr. Anderson back in 1999 and 2001 sessions. So this goes a long ways back, and I've testified many times. I'm not sure how much more there is to add except to Representative Lindsay's testimony, except to say that just a few clarifying things. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act that was passed by Congress in 1993 was overridden in a case called Bernie versus Flores in 1997 by the U.S. Supreme Court. But it didn't override the federal application of it, meaning that federal standard applies to federal situations, but it doesn't apply to the states. So that law still exists, okay, that standard that applies a compelling governmental interest and least restrictive means test standards. This bill specifically, because RLUIPA was so narrowly tailored to prisoners and land use situations, does not provide a general protection for religious free exercise in Oregon. And it goes back to the Supreme Court's decision by a Justice Scalia and a narrow majority of the court in Employment Division of Oregon versus Smith, a case that originated right here, the peyote case that some of us are familiar with, of which generally applicable laws were upheld against drug use while on the job, or the effects of drug use while on the job, which is what happened in that case. But A much larger issue loomed out of that was, were the Indians involved? Galen Black and one other gentleman, did they have the right to perform their ritual? And then make sure they don't come in to work high, so to speak. And the Supreme Court, in fact, the Oregon Supreme Court had dealt with this very carefully and judiciously and said, yes, they have that right. And, you know, delineated and explained the compelling state interest and least restrictive means test. But then out of nowhere, out of the blue, Justice Scalia decided to take this case up and demand that it be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court, just plucked it out of thin air, which the Supreme Court can do at the state level and say, hey, we need to hear this. And so the court decided to hear it, and basically what was dismissed was the compelling state interest and least restrictive means tests that go back to a very specific case dear to the heart of my church denomination, the Seventh-day Adventist Church. It involved a woman named Mrs. Sherbert. Sherbert versus Verner, and it involved a woman who would not make herself available for work on Saturday, her Sabbath, as required by the state's unemployment compensation law. And the court stated that was insufficiently compelling to warrant an infringement upon the free exercise of her sincerely held religious belief. So that standard, which was those two standards were the tests that were used for all religious free exercise disputes, especially when governmental bodies come in and question somebody's free exercise rights and their practice of those of their religion. That was struck down, and Oregon has not remedied that statutorily ever since. And so all we're asking for is a statutory correction. That's really at play here. Nothing more. And I might add, there's three things that this bill does not do, and these are important qualifiers. First, they do not inform individuals and institutions that they are somehow protected under the constitutional shelter of the free exercise of religion, no matter what they do. An example of that would be faith healing involving children, which you have currently dealt with here. For us, faith healing without the use of modern medicine, both together, is liable for abuse and even murder. And so that is something that the state has a right to say, hey, we have a compelling interest to intervene here and question this practice because this involves an innocent child that's helpless. Okay, so that's clear. That's only one example. Of course, there are many others. It doesn't provide a link.
Sorry to interrupt you. Yeah. We have your testimony. If
okay.
You could kind of just summarize,
good.
We'd appreciate that.
Sure.
Thank you.
Well, in short, it doesn't produce a lot of unintended consequences at the state level, and it hasn't in the states that have passed these, and it doesn't provide a blank check to be discriminating toward others or harassing people in the workplace. So I think it's a fair and reasonable bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions? Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And really, for either of you, as you've looked at all the other states that have passed state RFRAs, obviously there's some differences between different states. Any insights into the experience in those states of states that may have gone too far, may have not gone far enough? What are the lessons learned as you look at other states, especially those that have implemented it for several years?
I think that I haven't done a full-fledged research on especially these states that have passed it. I think the primary differences are some of them do have the land use portion of it, and I think that's generally has more case law and disputes around that. I think they all generally also have let's restore the burden from the individual, put the burden on the state for the compelling interest. But as far as drilling down and distinguishing some hot topics that have happened there, I'm not aware of any.
Well, I can't answer your question specifically because I haven't done that full research myself either, which I have mentioned to you that I would, although I thought at one time this bill was not going anywhere, but I'm so glad that we do have a chance to have a hearing here, so I haven't followed through based upon your original request for that. But there have been varying standards in the bill language from state to state. Some are more comprehensive and some are not. As far as the parade of horribles that some may bring forward, I would ask, what are the real cases involved? I think what we're asking for here, like in the case of the Sunnyside Methodist Church that occurred back in 1999 in Portland, where the city came in and basically shut down their feeding services and worship program on Wednesday nights, and also limited their church services on Sunday to 70 people in attendance when it held more than 500. That clearly was not a compelling interest that could pass any burden of proof, and I just think that's problematic. They reversed and they had a hearing, but it was a huge public outcry. The entire religious community of Portland came. We all came together and cried foul, and they listened, and so it was wonderful. But it's instances like that that can be problematic.
Thank you. Any more? Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Ginger Martin. And then I'll call up, after Ginger's done, Michael McCauley, Andrea Meyer, and Mary Williams. Together.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I am Ginger Martin, Assistant Director for Transitional Services with the Department of Corrections, and I'm here to state our concerns regarding House Bill 3609. We're concerned about the operational and fiscal impacts that House Bill 3609...
Ginger, could you put that mic just a little bit closer to you?
Yeah, thank you. We're concerned about the operational and fiscal impacts that House Bill 3609 would likely have on state corrections. House Bill 3609 establishes a strict scrutiny level of legal protection for religious exercise by Department of Corrections inmates. Because federal law already provides strict scrutiny protection, the department questions whether there is a need to create additional religious liberty protection to state prison inmates. By so doing, 3609 will likely increase inmate claims and litigation in state courts, and also inmate challenges to administrative disciplinary orders issued to inmates for violation of department conduct rules. House Bill 3609 lacks an important limitation on prison inmates' ability to file religious exercise claims and suits. First, the bill doesn't include an exhaustion requirement. The federal law does require inmates to exhaust all administrative grievance remedies before they can sue the Department of Corrections in federal court. Through this internal administrative grievance procedure, we are then able oftentimes to address the inmate complaints at the lowest possible level before it reaches litigation. The internal process also allows us to take corrective action, which might satisfy the inmate, to do an internal review and filter out frivolous claims, and to do an internal review that might serve to narrow or clarify the controversy and lead to a more efficient resolution of the dispute in later litigation. Second, House Bill 3609 lacks a safe harbor provision. This provision protects the Department of Corrections and its employees from liability if the department changes a policy that might result in a substantial burden on inmates' religious exercise. Third, House Bill 3609 broadly defines the term exercise of religion to include any religiously motivated belief or practice, even those that are not mandated by or central to a particular religious faith. Because of the breadth of religious exercise that is protected under this definition, we believe that the definition will increase inmate claims and litigation and thereby costs to the state. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Thanks, Ginger. Okay, Andrew Meyer, Michael McCauley, and Mary Williams. And if you have written testimony, if we can get it and read it, if you just summarize. We have another bill that we have a number of people who want to testify to, so appreciate your time.
Okay. Mark? Mr. Co-Chairs and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Michael McCauley, executive director of the League of Cities. I would reiterate the testimony that you just heard from the Department of Corrections. This is the explosive potential for a lot of litigation. One of the reasons that the Religious Freedom Restoration Act disappeared was because it was a broad shotgun approach to addressing issues that were raised. The federal government came back with the RLUIPA legislation that's been previously mentioned, zeroing in on land use and zeroing in on prisoners' rights. In those two arenas, the Department of Justice of the U.S. government investigates, there is settled case law, and there are reasonable standards. In looking at what this would do in Oregon, currently, if you were looking at an employment situation, you would look at whether or not accommodation would be done without a substantial burden placed on the employer. This would be a different standard. This would be a standard that would require the Oregon courts to go through a lot of litigation to flesh out why it is that the current laws to protect religious exercise and protection of religious beliefs in the workplace by the current laws, both federal and state, are inadequate. And that's one example of how this would put us in a situation where we believe that we would have a lot of litigation over issues that are currently very well covered in both state and federal law. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. We are here today in opposition to House Bill 3609. And I think, you know, the ACLU understands and has worked hard to protect individuals' rights to engage in religious practices. I will note that our Oregon constitutional provisions when it comes to religious freedom are more numerous than the federal constitution, and I will quickly quote a court case noting that these provisions obviously worded more broadly than the federal First Amendment and are more remarkable in the inclusiveness and adamancy with which rights of conscience are to be protected from government intrusion. And that is our own Oregon Constitution. And the ACLU recently concluded litigation for quite a while against the Oregon School Athletics Association on behalf of students from a religious school because they wanted to play in the basketball tournament but were forced either to forfeit or not participate at all because of their Sabbath and their religious practices. And the USAA would not make any reasonable accommodations. We didn't need this law to successfully proceed and finally win in the state of Oregon, and now USAA must make reasonable accommodations for those students at the Seventh-day Adventist and other places. Indeed, we are concerned, though, that this law not only will affect civil rights laws, but I will touch on in a moment briefly, a wide scope of other laws. And to note, ACLU nationally was part of RLUIPA, which is the Religious Land Use Institutionalized Persons Act, because land use and institutionalized persons were the most areas that were litigated in the issue, and that law in 2000 provided necessary protections and have had important effects. It addressed problems such as home worship meetings and Bible studies, soup kitchens and homeless shelters, remodeling or expanding worship spaces, and the ability to build in a locality. Indeed, it would and has protected the Sunnyside Methodist Church. So those areas are covered. Interestingly enough, most of the cases prior to that time, which were having to do with restrictions, were on religious minorities. And the groups that account for less than 9% of the population were over 50% of the cases, but thanks to RLUIPA, those issues have been addressed. The compelling standards put in this law, if a person asserts a public body burdening a person's exercise of religion, the public body has the burden of establishing a compelling government interest, and the law is in its least restrictive means. That's the highest possible standard. It's equivalent to strict scrutiny, and oftentimes it's an impossible standard for a local government to meet. Civil rights laws prohibit discrimination on the basis of race, religion, national origin, gender, sexual orientation, and disability. And we would hope courts would find these laws sufficiently compelling. But that's not necessarily been the case. The Ninth Circuit in 1999, in Alaska case, Thomas versus Anchorage Equal Rights Commission, applied a strict scrutiny standard to a landlord who asserted that renting to anyone not married burdened that landlord's religious freedom.
Andrea, We've got your...
I'm summarizing. I'm not...
Are you really? Okay. All right.
I do hope I can make the few points I would like to cover this afternoon. I know time is of short.
Thank you.
I will proceed. Wow. The court held...
Use that gavel.
That this violated the landlord's rights. The economic interest of the unmarried couple was not to be... the landlord's rights superseded that. Fortunately, the case was vacated. But I want to raise another legal complication, because not all protected characteristics of race, religion, gender, and so on have the same standard of scrutiny. We know race, if there's a discrimination based on race, the courts review that at the highest level of strict scrutiny. However, the same is not the case for gender, and the courts are more deferential in the standard. So will a person receive less accommodation, less protection, when another person asserts that either accommodations or services violate that person's religious beliefs, and it's a woman? Also, I want to note that sincerely held religious belief, and what is someone invoking as a religious belief, is not required to be set in writing or a tenet of the belief. It is what the person sincerely believes. And so that means for almost any situation, a person can invoke a sincerely held religious belief, and the government will now need to meet the compelling standard. We are concerned this runs a real risk of chaos. There are many religions and many practices more than I can name, and I'm certainly not going to name any of them here. But some do have strict beliefs about women and child custody or divorce. What about religious beliefs regarding unmarried pregnant women, non-married couples, interracial couples, interreligious families? What about child welfare laws? A number of those laws could face a challenge, and I'll just note a few ideas. We do not outlaw in this country circumcision, male circumcision. But we do, and I think many of us would agree rightly, prohibit female circumcision. But both are done under the basis of religious practices. So what's going to happen under this when the government has to prove a compelling standard? Which is going to win out? Criminal laws. This session, as you know, Senator Starr has passed a bill regarding faith-based and defenses in criminal cases. This passage of this law, we believe, could open the door to means of challenging that law. What about animal welfare laws? Many religions have animal sacrifices laws. Some are consistent with Western practices, others are not. I will note only one. In 1995, in Fresno, California, a Hmong shaman, performed a ritual to send the spirit of a German shepherd puppy to hunt down the evil spirit that was tormenting his wife. This involved others beating the puppy to death on the front porch while he chanted over its body. Now, fortunately, he did plead guilty to criminal animal cruelty, but what would he do if he could invoke House Bill 3609? What if he did not beat the animal to death but sacrifice the dog in the same way we currently sacrifice farm animals that are legally done? We don't believe that these are speculative, that these are the types of issues that will be raised. We think that the law is not necessary, that the RLUIPA covers the issues that are most important, and for all these reasons, for the intended purposes of this law, we urge you not to proceed further. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairs, members of the committee, Mary Williams, Deputy Attorney General from the Department of Justice, and I'll be very brief. You've heard some of the concerns raised that when you look at where the current law is, you look at where this law expands, both in terms of the kinds of cases that it might cover and the level of scrutiny that the courts would give to those cases. Our concern is simply that there's going to be the requirement that there be additional legal services for state agencies to try to deal with this increased litigation that we anticipate as we look at the implications of this bill. We have not tried to define that in terms of a fiscal impact. We're happy to try to work with agencies to set that out. Our experience in similar kinds of expansions of protections tells us that it takes 10 to 15 years for many of the legal issues to actually work their way through the system, and until you have some sort of resolution of some of the questions that are going to arise under this. And so we simply wanted to flag that as a concern going forward. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mary. Any questions?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe for Andrea, maybe for Mary, you can jump in if you like. The going back to
1993. We're really going back to 1990, the Smith case. 1993, ACLU, I think, was an active part of the coalition that actually passed the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which had the compelling government interest test, had least restrictive manner test. Are there some ways, I mean, obviously there was a rationale to support that, and then it was ultimately, I think it was in 97, thrown out again by the Supreme Court, at least the applicability of the states. Is there something left there? Because obviously that included, we've dealt with institutionalized persons, we've dealt with land use, which I would agree were the largest factors in terms of raw cases, which is actually the good news is we're dealing with the narrow remaining issues. Is there a way to deal with this issue and to deal with the remaining issues that don't have the unintended consequences that some of you have talked about, but do deal with appropriately putting in place that compelling governmental interest, least restrictive tests? I'll just put a question mark right there.
You want to start?
You want to respond? Chair Hunt, and so I can say that even the ACLU has made mistakes, or at least a national. When we originally did support RFRA, or they did, and rightly realized at some point that these would affect civil rights laws, and as such, that was the fundamental basis for which we no longer support that. I am not sure what is left that we are trying to narrowly deal with. Certainly this bill goes everywhere, so we're not even beginning to. But I'm not clear what gaps are still there that either the Oregon Constitution or, like, we were able to prevail under statutory with the Oregon School Athletic Association case, which was not either institutionalized persons or prisons, where we were successful in that, where the gap is left that we need to fix.
Co-chairs, Representative Hunt, I mean, it is possible that I think if we worked at looking at where those gaps may be, that we could have a more targeted approach to this. And I think some of the concerns really do have to deal with the level of scrutiny that the courts would be permitted to do, the really high burden that you're placing on the government in terms of justifying its actions, and also the fact that simply having the attorney fee provision in here invites additional litigation beyond maybe those key cases that you're hoping to address with this broader legislation. And so there might be some ways to actually sort of more narrowly target kind of the level of review by the court, the level of burden on the government to justify its actions, and the consequences of the litigation that might narrow the impact of a bill like this.
I would hope that there can be some work on this in the interim. I think making sure that there's not a negative impact on any kind of civil rights protections is exactly the way to go. I personally like having the burden on the government to make its case. I actually think that's a good thing. For the same reason, whether that's in discrimination on civil rights, discrimination on religious free exercise, or discrimination anywhere. Maybe there's a path in the interim. I think Representative Lindsay's very open to that.
Chair, we're happy to meet, and I should clarify, we'd probably like to fix a Smith decision when it comes to peyote use. I'm not sure that everyone here would choose to fix the same things that we think might need to be fixed when it comes to religious exercise, but that would be one area. But yes, we're happy to engage in discussions to see if there is some narrow areas that would provide some protections that otherwise somehow are not there under our Oregon Constitution or statutory scheme as present.
Thanks. Thank you.
To close a public hearing on House Bill 3609, and going to move quickly through the work session of some bills, and then members would like to stay here for what it takes to finish out House Bill 3676 for a public hearing. So open up a work session on House Bill 2256.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2256, I believe you're quite familiar with. We've discussed this in May and as early as February. This authorizes complaints regarding alleged violations of election law to be filed electronically and does a lot of miscellaneous things that the Secretary of State put together regarding elections. You have the Dash 1 amendment, which deletes a provision in the original bill that moves county judge candidacy filing to county clerks. And you have the Dash 2 amendment, which adds the clarification language governing the nomination and election of nonpartisan offices. It requires that explicit procedures for security of unused ballots be included in any county election security plan. It authorizes county clerks to publish notices of election and ballot titles electronically. It repeals provisions for elections to determine whether dogs may run at large, and it makes other technical changes to Oregon election law.
Thank you. Chair Hunt.
Mr. Chair, I move. Can I go ahead and move the amendment separately?
I think that would probably be best.
Okay, just so there's clarity. I would begin, Mr. Chair, by moving the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2256.
Chair Hunt moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2256. Is there an objection? Seeing none, so moved.
Mr. Chair, I would move the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2256.
Chair Hunt moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2256. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so moved.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2256 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Chair Hunt moves House Bill 2256 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Actually, yeah, correction. To the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Discuss this one to death, huh, Steve? Okay. Any call the roll, please.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Representative
Freeman?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative
Holby?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt?
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson?
Aye. House Bill 2256 passes. Anyone interested in carrying that? Representative Berger?
I'd be happy to do it. I just can't wait to stand up and say that we aren't going to let any more dogs run at large.
Okay, what
else? I'll have some questions to carry.
Okay, well, maybe Steve can. All right. We'll close a work session on House Bill 2256 and open a work session on House Bill 3636.
Mr. Chairman, this is House Bill 3636. It requires applications for state fish and wildlife commission licenses, tags, and permits to have a separate section where the applicants can make voluntary contributions to be used for predatory animal control to the extent allowed under federal and state law. There is no amendment to this. You have a fiscal statement issued, which I believe that we've copied to you. This is a bill that has a subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee.
I don't know if you want.
Do you want to say anything further on it, or? Okay. That's it.
I might have a question for you, but I don't.
Mr. Chair, sure. I would move House Bill 3636 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
To the floor with a due pass recommendation with subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Chair Hunt moves House Bill 3636 to as a subsequent referral to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
To the floor with a due pass recommendation, okay. With a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, you said it. Thank you. Any discussion? Seeing none, Amy, would you call the roll, please?
Representative
Berger?
Aye. Representative
Freeman?
Yes.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative
Holby?
Aye.
Representative Winger?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye. Close the work session on House Bill 3636 and open a work session on
Do you want to get a carrier for that? Do you want to ask?
Well, it's Ways and Means.
Ways and Means. It's going to Ways and Means.
Sorry.
So we'll have great things.
Yes.
Eventually, yeah.
I'm ready.
Open a work session on SCR 17.
Mr. Chairman, this is SCR 17. This memorializes former Coos County Commissioner Andy Jackson.
Okay, Bill Cooting and Dave Barr.
We have just a work session on SCR 17.
Okay.
Would you like further explanation on it?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, we were wanting to get this to the floor so that it would catch up with the Nikki Whitty resolution that you had last week.
And so we put it on for work session today. Those of you with good memories will remember that it was first read this morning.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wingert.
I know this is out of turn, but I would move SCR 17 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Wingert moves SCR 17 to the House floor with a due adopt.
For that.
Any questions? Amy, would you call the roll, please?
Representative Freeman.
Yes.
Representative Garrett.
Aye.
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative
Bennett. Aye.
Representative
Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative
Berger.
Aye.
Chair Hunt.
Aye.
Chair Olson.
Aye. SCR 17 passes, and okay, Representative Speaker Roebling. Okay, we'll carry. Okay. Close a work session on SCR 17, and I'm going to open a public hearing.
We have one more.
This one right here.
You should have a public hearing now. Yeah, sorry.
Public hearing, open a public hearing and work session on SCR 14.
Mr. Chairman, this is SCR 14 and memorializes Polk County Commissioner Mike Propes.
Okay, Bill Cluding and Dave Barrows this time.
Mr. Chairman, I was asked by Dave Barrows to express his regret that he needed to leave. Said he was a very good friend with Mr. Propes and was hoping that you would pass the bill. I just pass it on.
Yeah, but we do have Representative Berger, our own Representative Berger. Bill, come on up.
Ready? For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20. Let me tell you about Mike Propes. I knew him first as a member of the Chemeketa Board, and then I knew him as sort of the Polk County Commissioner. I knew him as the sort of preeminent elected official in our county. He knew everything about Polk County. But mostly, I knew Mike Propes as a friend. If you needed political advice, he was your guy. Policy advice, he was your guy for that. How things worked in Polk County, he was your guy. Who to go to if you needed something to happen in Polk County, he was your guy. What needed to happen in Polk County? You knew that too. Those are the questions I would always ask Mike and everybody else that did. And the amazing thing is that he would answer them with incredible humility. You never felt like this was a big kingmaker. This was a guy who just cared a lot and knew a lot. He was a huge mountain of a man, and his heart was just as big. He was full of big, important ideas, but his feet were firmly planted in the soil of Polk County, and he could dream big, but he could make those dreams happen in an amazing way. Mike Propes was a friend of mine, and I miss him. We lost him this year on my birthday, and I'm just honored to stand before you and ask you to support this resolution. Thank you.
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, Committee for the Record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial. Kind of hard to follow that right there, but Mike Propes was a longtime friend of mine. We worked on timber issues for almost 30 years. Mike was the driver behind the Secure Rural Schools Act. He had total respect in the halls of Congress. When Mike spoke, they listened. Many times I was in D.C. with Mike. We traveled this state. Oregon was all he thought about. He even helped the other states that was tied into this secure rural school funding. Mike was on the go all the time. We'll find a hard time replacing Mike. He always thought about the O&C counties. What if? How can we? We still have that problem ahead of us. Mike was here today. He would tell us we have to step forward. We have to get something done for these rural counties for the good of the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Okay. Well, any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Bruce, we are in work session.
Mr. Chair, I would move SCR 14 to the floor with the do adopt recommendation.
Chair Hunt moves SCR 14 to the House floor with the do adopt recommendation. Is there any objection? Any questions? Okay, Amy, would you call the roll, please?
Representative
Sheeran. Aye.
Representative
Holby. Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Berger.
Aye.
Representative Freeman.
Aye.
Co-Chair Hunt.
Aye.
Co-Chair Olson.
Aye. SCR 14 passes, and Representative Berger, you be kind of, thank you very much, and thank you for bringing this forward. We close the work session on SCR 14 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3676.
Mr. Chairman, we have Beth Herzog here to do the administration on that bill.
Chair Olson and Hunt, for the record, Beth Herzog, committee staff. House Bill 3676 requires the Environmental Quality Commission and the Department of Environmental Quality to consider, to the extent allowed by the Clean Water Act, the economic, social, and environmental costs of implementing water quality standards in relation to human health benefits. It requires DEQ to identify one major municipal and one major industrial MPDES permittee and that is willing to apply for a pilot water quality variance. It requires DEQ to develop certain water quality variance templates if the permittees do not apply for variance. DEQ is required to begin working on multiple discharge water quality variants or multiple discharge or variances for multiple sectors from the applicable human health criteria for polychlorinated bioethanols or other pollutant with more immediate need. It requires DEQ to identify surface waters of the state where arsenic concentrations naturally exceed the applicable water quality standard and to propose revisions to the water quality standards that are no more stringent than naturally occurring pollutant levels. It establishes timeline and process for accomplishing the act and declares an emergency effective on passage.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Catherine Van Natta and Myron Burr and Mike Sullivan, you want to come up?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, for the record, Catherine Venata, Governmental Affairs Manager of the Northwest Pulp and Paper Association. Northwest Pulp and Paper is a technical trade association representing the pulp and paper mills in Oregon, Washington, Idaho on environmental and energy issues. On behalf of NWPPA, I participated extensively in the DEQ process to establish new human health toxics water quality standards over the last 5 years. And Oregon will soon be adopting the most stringent statewide toxic standards in the country here in several weeks. And this uncharted territory will result in regulatory uncertainty, confusion, and a large cost burden to the first facility that will seek a water permit after passage of the new rules. Simply, what House Bill 3676 does is set a path forward in regulation in DEQ's water statutes that has the department establish a prototype variance and a work in a work group to do this. It can either be a template or it can be a variance for one specific facility, but it provides some certainty for your regulated companies. It creates a variance for PCBs, polychlorinated biphenols, are another pollutant of concern for facilities that face the same exact issues on the Willamette and Columbia River, where our main dischargers are located and the majority of our population. It has a process to address arsenic, a naturally occurring earth metal, known to be present in concentrations of in-state waters that would even violate the proposed standard that's in the rule package. I want to make that clear. Even though the standard in the rule package is being made less stringent for arsenic, there are still some cities and other folks that will be facing issues with complying with the arsenic standard. This bill sets a regulatory path forward for those folks facing arsenic issues. And it establishes legislative findings, and it has reporting mechanisms back to the legislature so you can track the implementation of the water quality standards and the issuance of variances going forward. And we ask your support to provide regulatory certainty from your folks in the state of Oregon, and I can provide you with the cost figures of providing treatment to treat to these water quality standards, if it is even available. But I can tell you in summary that the installation of treatment technology to treat to the new standards based on an engineering study of 4 pulp and paper mills in Oregon to install technology to treat is $19 to $118 million per facility, with annual operation and maintenance costs of $4 to $28 million, depending upon the size of the facility. That's the reason why, with the large cost burden there, which I might add is more than the book value of one of our pulp and paper mills when sold on the auction block after it went bankrupt. So we believe that we would not stall that type of cost prohibitive technology, rather we would close, that we would seek variances from the water quality standards rather than try to install that cost prohibitive technology. And I'd like to turn it over to Myron Burr.
Thank you, Catherine. Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, the committee members, my name is Myron Burr. I'm the Environmental Affairs Manager for Celtronic Corporation in Portland. We're a silicon wafer manufacturer. We employ about 850 people. We're a very proud member of the Portland and Oregon community. Been in business here for 31 years. We've been recognized 30 times by state and federal and local agencies for our environmental achievements. In 2007, we were honored with the State Sustainability Focus Award. So we take these environmental concerns and issues very seriously. However, we also recognize that it's important that there be protections for not only the environment, but also for businesses, so we have jobs for the people of Oregon. And in that respect, we participated, like Catherine did, for the past 2 years with DEQ to develop these water quality standards. And an important aspect of that process was the development of implementation mechanisms that Catherine alluded to. Those were developed sort of in concept. They have not been fully developed. We don't believe they've been developed to a point where we could have an implementable pathway through the regulatory maze. This is part of it's due to the fact that this has never been done in Oregon before. There's never been a variance issued by DEQ, so DEQ has no experience with it. I think DEQ, frankly, would appreciate having a process developed for their regulated community so they would know how to go about it and provide the certainty that businesses need here in Oregon. So that's really important for both DEQ and the regulated community. As Catherine said, this bill addresses some important pollutants in the environment, some of which are naturally occurring, some of which are man-made, but everywhere. So this is the reason we spent so much time on this, is that we feel that, you know, with the low water quality standards that this state is going to adopt, which are the most stringent in the nation, there has to be a way to make it work. And so we've been working for a couple of years to make that happen. I have 30 years of experience in the engineering field, and as an engineer, I always like to have tools at my disposal that are effective, and I liken this the concept of a variance as a basically, you know, going into the trunk of your car when you have a flat tire and you find a lump of iron and you don't find the lug wrench you need. Somehow or other, we need to make that lump of iron into a lug wrench that's effective. So with that, I encourage your support of this bill. It's important for Oregon's environment and for Oregon's economy. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Okay. Thank you.
Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hunt, committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the political director for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. I don't know if I'll ever get that down correctly. But unfortunately, the poster child for us this year is Blue Heron. And early, you might read Willamette Week, February 8th of 2008, they predicted the demise of Blue Heron with early suits from environmental groups down to the ridiculous presidential trade agreements that we presently have and the future look like. It's been the whipsaw effect of pulp and paper jobs in this state, in the Northwest, and in Canada. Right now, scrap paper is sold to the Chinese 10% higher than we can buy it in the U.S. or Canada. They say whatever the price is, add 10%, we'll pay it, meaning our mills cannot afford to buy the scrap paper. The whipsaw effect of that is it comes back, as Senator Byers said last week in his committee, in a product that is produced in China two-thirds cheaper than we can do it here in the United States. AWPPW's population as a union has gone virtually in half in the last 2 years. These are high-skill, high-wage jobs with benefits. We have to have an economy with our ecology. I mean, I don't know where the tax base is going to come in the future. Tom McCall once said, come to Oregon again, but don't stay. I'll paraphrase it to say, don't stay because you won't be able to find a job. And there is no future in the industries for children to go into and work if things don't change around. We need a helping hand from you. Thank you. I'll answer any questions.
Questions? Okay. Thank you, Mike. Next panel, Sue Marshall and Teresa Hunsinger.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Sue Marshall. I'm here today representing Tualatin River Keepers and the Willamette River Keeper. They're opposed to this legislation. We believe that it's not needed, it is too prescriptive, and may weaken the state's approach to addressing toxic pollutants. There is a variance process that is available, although there haven't been an applicant that has gone through this process. DEQ, anticipating these new rules, together a work group to address the variance process. They developed a white paper on implementing water quality standards for toxic pollutants via NPDES permits. The purpose of this, their objective was to clarify the process to ensure efficiency and revise the rules for granting variances. There is already a bill related to variances, House Bill 3591, that I believe sailed out of the House. I don't think there's been opposition as it was amended. It's recently passed out of the Senate Environment Committee and is awaiting a third reading in the Senate. This would address the variance process and require that DEQ, to the extent feasible, minimize economic impacts and report back to the legislature February 15th, 2013. So there will be an opportunity for the legislative body to review the variance process as it's been implemented. We also believe that 3676 is too prescriptive of DEQ. We're concerned about singling out specific toxic PCBs and for the multi-discharger permit. The multi-discharger variance is a tool that was not recommended by DEQ's rulemaking work group, in part, as they stated, because there were only a few dischargers that this would apply to. There were only, I think, only three states where EPA has approved a multi-discharger variance, and they didn't feel like they had sufficient data to support this approach, although they did consider, will consider this as more information is available and the need arises. While we agree there's circumstances that would warrant a variance where there's natural occurring metals, arsenic, there remains concern that human activities can concentrate these substances and would urge some caution in assumptions on what is or isn't achievable by way of the states within the state's control. And I would just mention very quickly the Tualatin River is a prime example where phosphorus naturally occurring in the soils very high. The permit holder at that time considered the high or the very restrictive limit on phosphorus impossible to achieve, but due to litigation and that regulatory backstop, innovation occurred. They were able to meet their permit and are now actually recovering phosphorus and developing a useful product and a revenue stream. So I just would urge some caution in that respect, and we would not want a variance process to be a cheap and easy way to avoid stepping up and addressing serious pollutants that impact our water, public health, and aquatic species. So thank you very much for your consideration.
Teresa.
Good afternoon, co-chairs Olson and Hunt and members of the committee. My name is Teresa Huntsinger, and I am with the Oregon Environmental Council. HB 3676 is mostly the same as a bill, HB 2007, that was introduced earlier this session. And while we appreciate that the current bill does not include the delay of implementation that was a part of HB 2007, we are still opposed to some other aspects of HB 3676. So I will just highlight some of those concerns. I think you're getting handed out written copies of our testimony. So to begin with, we do not agree with the legislative findings in the beginning of the bill that include statements such as excessively stringent water quality standards that provide negligible or no human health benefits. The new water quality standards that are currently considered by the Environmental Quality Commission were designed to protect people who regularly consume fish, such as tribal communities, and they are not currently protected by the existing standards. And this is a serious environmental justice issue that we don't think should be marginalized by the Oregon legislature in this bill. The legislative findings in HB 3676 emphasize the costs of achieving the standards while downplaying the benefits of protecting human health and the environment. So we can't support that kind of biased language. The sections 4 and 5 that have to do with variances, the pilot variances and multiple discharger variances, we believe are too prescriptive, and they're essentially telling DEQ how to do its job. We think it's best left up to DEQ in consultation with the EPA and with the stakeholder group that developed the rulemaking to determine whether and when it's appropriate to use a multiple discharger variance. We're also concerned that Section 6, the section regarding naturally occurring arsenic, could result in the EPA rejecting Oregon standards and that the EPA would have to promulgate standards for us. That's because according to the research that DEQ did while they were developing the rulemaking, EPA has stated that natural condition provisions can be used for aquatic life criteria, but they should not be used for human health criteria. That's because you can reason that aquatic species have naturally adapted to any of those naturally occurring background levels, but human health criteria must be designed to protect human health. So we don't think we should legislate something that might be rejected by the EPA. Lastly, the bill includes excessive reporting requirements that increase government costs. So as Sue mentioned, HB 3591, which appears poised to be passed, also requires DEQ to report to the legislature in 2013 on any variances that are issued. This bill would require DEQ to issue multiple reports to the legislature in 2013 and 2015. So we think these are duplicative requirements, and one report is adequate. So we would rather see DEQ spend their limited budgetary resources on actually protecting water quality than on writing reports about variances from water quality protections. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Questions?
Okay.
Letting you off easy right now. That's the deal. I think it's after 5. That's what
ready
it is.
To go home.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Olson and Hunt and members of the committee. My name is Greg Aldridge, and I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. Also with me is Deborah Studevant from our Water Quality Standards Program. I'm here today to testify and state that DEQ is neutral on the bill. There are a lot of components of this that it represents work that we know we need to do with the permitted community as we move forward. This bill stems from the anticipated adoption of revised water quality standards for toxics. We have been working with the bill proponents to ensure that the bill accomplishes what they intend and it is both legally sound and workable. Part of this is ensuring that the bill will not contain any elements that would prompt the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to reject water quality standards that DEQ submits for EPA approval. In anticipation of the adoption of revised standards, DEQ has been working over the past couple of years with permittees, as you heard earlier, EPA, and other stakeholders to develop innovative compliance methods for implementing water quality standards in permits. Several of these are included in DEQ's rulemaking package, and DEQ is in the process of developing detailed guidelines for implementing these rules. We share draft outlines of these documents with stakeholders in December, and we'll be providing draft documents, not outlines, but documents, at the Environmental Quality Commission meeting later this month with our rulemaking package. House Bill 3676 addresses some of these compliance tools and other issues related to the implementation of water quality standards and permits. Again, we support the work of the variances and the need to work with the community, but we are neutral on the bill itself. The bill largely requires DEQ to do work it already intends to do with existing resources. The timelines established in the bill are reasonable, and the requirement to submit several reports to the legislature is new work, but we do not see it as a significant workload. With that, I thank you for the opportunity to testify, and if you have any questions, we are both here to answer.
Do you have anything you want to add? Any questions? Okay.
I appreciate you coming forward.
President Holby. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, since you're neutral on the bill and you find that you're already working on some of these issues, do you find that the findings in this bill are accurate as well?
Co-Chair Olson and Representative Holvey, I guess we really hadn't thought about the findings. I think we do see that the need to protect human health through these water quality standards. So many people may see them as excessive. We think the path we're on is what's needed for protection of human health in Oregon. I don't know if that totally addressed your question.
No, but yeah. I can appreciate that.
This is a follow-up, or are you done?
Yeah.
The first time, not the last.
Okay. I'm good with the non-answer. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Talk to him outside. All right. Thank you. Okay. Very good. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing then on House Bill 3676, and we are adjourned.